This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After reporting from war zones since the 1980s, New York Times reporter Chris Hedges figured out he'd become addicted to war. With that disturbing realization, he gave up covering wars and wrote a book reflecting on how war changes people and countries. He's not a pacifist, but he thinks that particularly in times like these, we have to guard against the myths that romanticize war and render complex situations into moral absolutes. He's taken many risks during his career. As he describes, he's been in ambushes on desolate Central American roads, shot at in the marshes of southern Iraq, imprisoned in the Sudan, beaten by Saudi military police, deported from Libya and Iran, held hostage for a week by Iraq's Republican Guard, fired on by Serb snipers, and shelled for days in Sarajevo. Chris Hedges' new book is called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Let's start with a short reading.
I learned early on that war forms its own culture. The rush of battle is a potent and often lethal addiction, for war is a drug, one I ingested for many years. It is peddled by mythmakers, historians, war correspondents, filmmakers, novelists, and the state, all of whom endow it with qualities it often does possess: excitement, exoticism, power, chances to rise above our small stations in life, and a bizarre and fantastic universe that has a grotesque and dark beauty. It dominates culture, distorts memory, corrupts language, and infects everything around it, even humor, which becomes preoccupied with the grim perversities of smut and death. Fundamental questions about the meaning or meaninglessness of our place on the planet are laid bare when we watch those around us sink to the lowest depths. War exposes the capacity for evil that lurks not far below the surface within all of us, and that is why, for many, war is so hard to discuss once it is over.
That's Chris Hedges reading from his new book, War. War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. You're right, like every recovering addict, there's a part of me that remains nostalgic for war's simplicity and high, even as I cope with scars it has left behind. Where did you get hooked on war?
Well, my route to war, I went to seminary and, you know, read Just War Theory and Liberation Theology, and then as a teenager was fascinated by the Spanish Civil War and the Holocaust. And, you know, I wasn't a gun nut. I mean, I didn't subscribe to Soldier of Fortune and this kind of stuff. I mean, that does attract these kind of voyeurs. But I went to war, and I went to Latin America because this was in the early 80s. Latin America was ruled by military dictatorships, and I felt that as a young person, this was as close as I was going to come to fighting fascism in my lifetime, and that's why I went. However, once I went to El Salvador to cover the war. I was there for 5 years, and once I got caught up in combat, or once I experienced combat and experienced the rush of war, I became addicted to it. The same way anyone else who spends a lot of time in that environment becomes addicted to it. And it seemed, and I did it for a long time, for many years, ending with the war in Kosovo. It was a lifestyle that was terribly unhealthy. And, you know, I couldn't sort of wait for the next conflict. I mean, it was not accidental that there were reporters and photographers in Kosovo that I had worked with in El Salvador, which was, you know, almost 20 years ago.
Listen, in your book you describe, and I imagine this is one of the first times you were under fire. This was in, I think, San Salvador.
It was in Suchitoto, which was a town outside of San Salvador.
Okay, and you were under attack by rebels, and you were saying to yourself, God, if you get me out of here, I will never do this again. Talk a little bit about what you were experiencing and what was going through your mind at that moment.
At the moment that I was being shot at?
Yeah.
I had a range of emotions. I mean, the biggest was fear, of course. I was terrified, and I felt helpless. I couldn't move. I was desperately wanted to get out of there. You know, I wasn't big into prayer, and I mean, I put that in the book because it's true. And I, you know, would at that point would have made a bargain with anybody to get out alive. I didn't think I was going to get out alive.
Okay, now how'd you go from there to deciding that, well, in fact, you were going to go back from war, and not only that, you're going to go from war to war to war for about 20 years?
Because a half hour later, it was the greatest cosmic joke I'd ever played. And, you know, the excitement of being in a situation with that kind of intensity and that kind of danger and escaping was a huge rush. And it became a deadly kind of game. And I think it was a game I was playing, although not with the same kind of enthusiasm, in Kosovo. And it's a constant kind of cat and mouse, where the Serbs would cut a road into a village where they had murdered a bunch of Kosovar Albanians, cut most of the roads, and we'd walk in. And yes, you know, the motives are always mixed. You know, it had a higher purpose in that we wanted to document the kinds of atrocities that the Serbs were trying to cover up, as was also the case in the war in El Salvador. But it was also the rush of the game itself. And, you know, I think Churchill said, I can't remember the exact quote, but there's nothing quite like the exhilaration of being shot at without result. And that was very much part of the, and I think also one becomes initiated into the fraternity itself. I mean, there is a small group of photographers and camera people and reporters who do this. And I didn't ever really care particularly what my editors thought, but I cared an awful lot about what they thought. It was very important to me that they respect me and my work. And because I often did go, I mean, I worked for 10 years with this great reporter, Kurt Schork, who was killed in an ambush in Sierra Leone in May of 2000. And started in northern Iraq with him, and then was in Sarajevo and Kosovo. And it was important to me what Kurt thought. You know, his opinion of me, it mattered in a way that perhaps few other opinions did, because he'd been there. And Kurt was the perfect example of somebody who couldn't break free from the addiction. I mean, he couldn't break free, and it killed him.
You write about a friend you had in El Salvador when you were covering the war there. He was a war photographer. And he was nearly killed a few times in El Salvador, so he went back to Florida to get away from the war, did local stories for one of the papers there, was bored, returned to El Salvador, and you say from the moment he stepped off the plane, it was clear he had returned to die. He was actually shot a few months after he returned to El Salvador. You say it took him less than a minute to die. Do you see a certain type of war corresponding, a certain type of war reporting, as almost being a death wish?
I don't think it's a death wish. I think it's more a matter that you can't cope outside of that environment, and that when you, when Kurt and my friend Miguel Gil Moreno went down the road in Sierra Leone, I spoke to people who were with them when they were killed. I mean, they did what we all do. They were careful. Now, they got to a junction, Rugbury Junction, and their drivers wouldn't go on. So Kurt and Miguel said, okay, we'll drive. But, you know, we've all done that. I think they were weighing the risks. I think in this case, there was a kind of grimness with this photographer where he understood that he could sort of never go back. I think in the other cases, it was more that they couldn't function outside of that environment, that when they got back, they felt alienated from normal society. They had a hard time coping with the routine. They, it's hard to replicate that kind of excitement. And
did you have trouble coping in the other part of the world? Like,
terribly. Very hard.
Like what?
Well, all of that. I mean, I felt, you know, it's almost, you know, I would, well, especially in the middle of a conflict, when I come back, it was like I was looking at everything from the end of a long tunnel. I just felt like I was four or five steps removed. I saw so much of life as trivial. And I think that is one of the, if there are any good things about war, it does tend to put what's important in life in perspective. And sitting down with friends of mine it just seemed to me that their life was filled with a lot of banalities. I think that's unfair. I mean, I think I was unfair, but that's how I felt. And I sort of couldn't wait to go back. And I think, you know, wherever, and it was hard for me to stay out. And then when I finally decided to stop, it was probably 3 years before I was comfortable.
Why did you decide to stop?
Well, I covered the war in Kosovo, and, you know, I'd done, let's say, pretty much in and out of war zones for 15 years. I didn't get any zip out of it. I think that, you know, the first war you cover is almost like your first love affair. And you spend a lot of time after that trying to recreate it, and you can't. El Salvador was the experience of my life. And nothing I ever did, everything I did paled beside El Salvador, although, of course, Sarajevo was probably the most frightening place I was ever in. I couldn't recreate that. And I think that's part of what you're looking for. You're looking to recreate that initial experience where you accept the fact or you believe it's worth dying for, let's say, the story, for the cause, for... You're a believer, and I think in every other conflict you get to, you never are that naive again. By the time I got to Kosovo, you know, I knew how to do it. I'd been doing it a long time. It's what I did professionally. I knew what the sound of an incoming mortar was and an outgoing mortar, and I knew. You know, how to sort of smell out a situation and whether we should go forward or not. But I did it. I gripped my teeth and did it. There was no, you know, I did it with a kind of grim determination. And I didn't like it. I mean, I felt profoundly alone. I still believed in what I was doing, but I guess I wondered why I was still doing it. And I realized that it was time to stop. When I finished the war in Kosovo, I took a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard and spent the year reading classics, mostly translating Catullus and Virgil. And that was the beginning of my recovery. But it was hard and difficult. And I think and as you read, I mean, there'll always be a part of me that's nostalgic for that, because while, you know, I can never say that I was happy in the midst of a war zone, I felt a kind of fulfillment and a purpose. You know, I woke up every morning and I felt that what I was doing in life was incredibly important and meaningful. And that, you know, it's hard in a peacetime society to replicate that. I think part of what we're doing also, I just want to add, is we're running away. That also, you know, living day-to-day life in some ways is harder than living in the midst of a war. It's certainly more complicated. You don't have these sort of grand, momentous highs and causes. And I think, and Ernie Pyle wrote of this, and I think part of it is a fleeing from day-to-day responsibility.
My guest is New York Times reporter Chris Hedges. His new book is called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with New York Times reporter Chris Hedges. After reporting from war zones for many years, he realized he'd become addicted to war and ended that chapter of his life. He's written a new book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. You know, when you talk about your years as a war correspondent, you're approximately 20 years as a war correspondent, it sounds almost as if, you know, you talk about war addiction, it sounds almost as if you see yourself as having been a war addict who's now kind of gone through recovery and you're out the other end, and you still have to learn how to keep away, and that part of your life is in the past tense, but you still have feelings for it. It's just interesting to hear you talk that way about it. Do you feel like you're in this completely different phase of your life now?
I went back to Gaza for the New York Times and got caught in a very bad ambush in the Netzarim Junction. There was a kid shot and killed about 15 feet away from me. And I ended up sprinting down a road under pretty heavy fire with a bunch of young Palestinian boys and men who were carrying plastic bags full of Molotov cocktails. And I thought, you know, this is nuts. That's crazy. It's not, you know, I don't need this experience. I've had it. You don't stay lucky forever. I think it was, I really profoundly didn't like it. And I think it was just a realization that if I didn't stop, I was going to end up like Kurt, and that I had to force myself to stop.
Your new book is about the myths of war and the kick of war that some people experience. Do you feel, as a journalist, that journalists sometimes feed those myths? Do you feel like you ever did that yourself?
I think in wartime, it's very rare that any journalist doesn't feed the myth. I think in almost every war, if you look closely, the press is part of the problem. And the other thing that the press does is we not only perpetuate the myth of war, but we perpetuate the myth of our own nobility. And we, those of us that have been there, know full well the very dark side to what we do.
But I feel like I read a lot about the dark side, you know, particularly in the New York Times. I think they have excellent war correspondents, yourself included, though you're not doing it right now, who write about the dark side of war and who write about the tragedy, the deaths, the loss of limbs, the loss of health, the loss of freedom. And I think it paints a pretty grim picture. So explain to me how you think that your reporting helped feed the myth.
Well, I think that by writing about, I mean, let's take the war in Sarajevo, where on a daily basis we're trying to write about troop movements or positions or what the UN has done or the collapse of the safe area in Srebrenica or stuff. It oftentimes misses the fundamental point of what war is doing to the society itself. I think that, and especially in daily journalism, we tend to get caught up in daily events. I mean, that's our job. You know, one of the people never really, the war, every picture, every reportage of a war is heavily censored. I mean, when I got to Sarajevo, which was in 95, if a shell came in and landed, the pictures that were transmitted back, which by then were not being run, you know, and a lot of the television crews were upset because the editors were saying, well, you know, it just looks too much like the pictures. It's just too much repetition. There was kind of numbing. But even those pictures are cut. I mean, they're terrible, but they're not anywhere near as terrible as what they are. They just would be too shocking. You just couldn't transmit them. And print is always much tamer. I mean, especially I think the New York Times is pretty, and correctly so, pretty restrained. I mean, we don't sort of go in for huge graphic descriptions. So I think when I say we don't talk about the darkness of war, I think what we're not coping with is the disease of war itself. We may, and I think we do write about, you know, the tragedy and what happens, but whether we fundamentally get to the sickness that is war, I sometimes wonder. And then when I talk about ourselves, I think that there is, I think sometimes the press could be a little more honest about how they're part of the problem. I mean, certainly the Gulf War was an example of that. I mean, the press coverage was horrendous. We ate out of the military's hand. And there is a kind of scramble to be patriotic. I mean, it's a little easier when you're covering a conflict where you're not directly involved. But once your nation is directly involved, I think the press, especially because there is a kind of guilt among some of the press that they're only writing or reporting rather than actually engaging in the conflict, they see it as their duty to sustain morale, and there's a kind of self censorship that often takes place to sustain morale. That's less true when you're in a situation like Bosnia where we don't have troops on the ground, but if you look at the Persian Gulf War, or you look at the recent war in Afghanistan, I think, you know, generally the press assumes that that is their role.
Chris Hedges reports for the New York Times. His new book is called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He was a member of the New York Times team that won a Pulitzer Prize this year for its coverage of global terrorism. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's continue our interview with New York Times reporter Chris Hedges. He's reported from war zones from Latin America to the Middle East and the Balkans. After realizing he'd become addicted to war, Hedges ended that chapter of his life and took time off from reporting to write a book reflecting on how war changes individuals and countries. His new book is called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Well, you know, in talking about war, there's, I think, just a very interesting phenomenon happening in the United States, which is that a lot of Americans who have been very skeptical of recent wars, particularly of Vietnam, but also skeptical even of the Gulf War, feel so personally violated by the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon that this surge of patriotism has been experienced by people who haven't experienced it quite that way before, and people are flying flags who never dreamed they'd be doing that before. And I just wonder what your observations are of this phenomenon.
Well, I think that in every war, that is what happens. You know, if you look at the start of conflicts, there usually is an incident, real or created, whereby your innocents are horribly murdered by, you know, terrible forces of darkness. And that was true in the war in Bosnia, where supposedly, can't remember which was which, but there was a wedding party that was fired upon the initial stages of the war. It was true in El Salvador, where you had a peaceful demonstration before the start of the insurgency, or they were gunned down in the streets, which happened. I mean, it's real. But I think that is always what triggers that kind of stuff. So it's not any exception, and it's a kind of natural response. There's the kind of banding together. You know, it does create a kind of pride, and I think that one has to be very cautious because, you know, that kind of communal solidarity in an emergency, and, you know, having been in situations and lived through it, I'm awfully thankful that it does exist. I mean, where people will really watch out for you, and at the same time, one has to not allow that to blind yourself to your own faults and your own need for change and your own injustices. I mean, you know, the problem with that is that, you know, injustice suddenly always becomes committed only by the other and not by us. And that's the danger of that kind of patriotism and self-glorification. And it's been true in every single conflict that I've covered. We have great pity for our own and no pity for the other, and those we oppose have the same illness. And it's only when you break free from that, I think, that you can begin to communicate, because you don't. What you end up doing is speaking in two different languages. You speak past each other. There is no common language in which you can speak anymore. I mean, you see that between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I mean, you ask Hamas why they're doing suicide bombings, and they say, well, the Israelis, and they say, we only started doing suicide bombings after Baruch Goldstein shot down the worshippers in the mosque in Hebron, and because the Israelis kill our civilians, and when they stop killing our civilians, we'll stop killing their civilians. But they don't speak anymore. There's no common language, and that's why after a conflict, it's so important that you create, rather than a mythic history, a real history, as was so, you know, was done in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So at least people have a basis by which to talk. And that's always the danger of war, is that, you know, there's no longer a common vocabulary, and therefore there's no longer a possibility of a resolution.
Our country might be going to war with Iraq. We might be invading Iraq and trying to overthrow Saddam Hussein. As you listen to the Bush administration make its case for going into Iraq and sending thousands and thousands of American troops to Iraq, what are you listening for? What are you listening for between the lines?
Well, I'm listening for a real, incredible threat. And, you know, I covered Iraq for many years and have no illusions about Saddam Hussein. He's about as bad as they come.
I'm going to stop here and say that you were kidnapped by Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard right after the Gulf War, and you were held hostage for a week.
Right. The evidence has certainly not been shared with the American public, and according to our allies, including our British allies, it's not been shared with them. And I think what worries me about this war on terrorism is that it's this never-ending conflict. I worry that, you know, that the many wars that nations get drawn into, when they're ill-conceived, become incredibly dangerous swamps that it's hard to wade out of. And, you know, it's pretty easy to start a war and pretty hard, especially when your nation's prestige is on the line, to walk away from. Iraq is, there may be credible evidence that, you know, he's on the verge of building a nuclear bomb, and but having covered conflict after conflict, oftentimes assumptions are made or on faulty intelligence or on weak intelligence, and to go wading into a conflict of the magnitude of Iraq, we've got to be very, very sure. And I guess I'm looking for that kind of evidence, and that's certainly not been shared yet. And the other thing that worries me is that does not appear that anybody's particularly thought out how they're going to do it. And once it gets started, it's just a sinkhole. You can't walk away from it. So I guess all of that worries me. It worries me that in the end, war just cannot be begun or waded into lightly. And I guess that's my biggest fear.
What about the counter fear, which is that if we don't invade Iraq, we might be the target of a chemical attack, a biological attack, or in the not-too-distant future, a nuclear attack?
Well, if there's credible evidence that that's something that Baghdad is planning, then obviously it has to be preempted. That said, if we go to war with Iraq and he has that stuff, you can be pretty certain he's going to try and use it. So, I mean, that's the only way he's going to strike back. His Scuds don't make it to New York. So if he goes after us, once we go into a conflict and he does have that stuff, one would assume he's going to, and knowing Saddam Hussein, there's going to be no real, not much is going to stay his hand. I remember after the Gulf War asking Schwarzkopf, number two, because I went into Kuwait with the Marine Corps, and we all were prepared, and our biggest fear were these artillery shells that had chemical and biological agents in them. We knew they had them. They blew the dumps up after the war. They had a range of 70 kilometers, if I remember correctly, so we were all within range. And I asked him why, and he said the only reason why Baghdad didn't use them is because the command and control was broken between Baghdad and the front lines, and he couldn't get the orders out. So if we start tangling with Iraq, and he does have this stuff, whether he planned to use it or didn't plan to use it, I would suspect that once we're in the midst of a conflict, he will try and use it, knowing the Iraqi regime.
Do you feel like you're watching your own country go through some of the things you've watched in other countries as we are in the midst of this war on terrorism and are considering invading Iraq? You've covered so many other countries' wars now. You're seeing your own country participating in it.
Yeah, I mean, I look around and sometimes think we've become the Serbs. The rhetoric, the belief that somehow everything we do, especially in the Middle East, is just and good. The lack of introspection, lack of self-criticism, lack of understanding of what we do in the world and how we're perceived in the world. I mean, we have now built a sort of triple alliance with Putin and Sharon, who are pretty dubious characters, frankly, especially among the Muslim world. I mean, the Muslim world looks at us through the prism of Palestine and Chechnya, and it's hard to, I think, at this point, defend either what the Russians are doing in Chechnya or the Israelis are doing in places like the West Bank and Gaza. Yet we have built a pretty uncritical alliance with these two people, and that, you know, that the failure to look at who we've allied ourselves with and what our power represents and you know where we're laying our forces in this war on terror, I think we're becoming increasingly isolated and in the sort of gush of patriotic fervor, we're not asking the right questions. We resort to the kind of cliches, the very hollow cliches and rhetoric that always typify a country that's marching into war. And I mean, that is the, you know, that has just been repeated in conflict. I don't know how many conflicts I've covered, 10 or 11 or 12, in every single one I've been in. And we're no different from anyone else.
You're no longer covering war for the New York Times. One of the things you're doing now is writing occasional contributions to the Public Lives column, which is a series of short portraits of interesting people that appears in the Metro section. Where do you see yourself heading now journalistically?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not sure. You know, I think probably backing away from journalism to a certain extent. And, you know, I've written another piece for Harper's that will be out. I think longer pieces, stuff that mm-hmm. perhaps is not as tied to daily events. I think it's, you know, after everything that I've been through and everywhere that I've been, I guess I know I'm not going back to that. I'm not completely sure where I'm going, to tell the truth.
Well, Chris Hedges, I wish you good luck, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Chris Hedges reports for the New York Times. His new book is called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. This is Fresh Air.